Connor stared out of the side window at the pale green palace of the Hermitage. It couldn't have been in greater contrast to the prison he had just left. He looked up at the clear blue sky and back down at the citizens walking up and down the streets. How quickly he had been made aware of how much he valued his freedom. Once they were on the south side of the river, the driver swung right, and after a few hundred yards pulled up in front of the Palace of Justice. The car door was opened by a waiting policeman. If Connor had any thoughts of escape, the other 50 officers on the pavement would have caused him to think again. They formed a long reception line as he climbed the steps into the huge stone building. He was marched to the front desk, where an officer pinned his left arm to the counter, studied his wrist, and entered the number 12995 on the charge sheet. He was then taken down a marble corridor towards two massive oak doors. When he was a few paces away, the doors suddenly swung open, and he entered a packed courtroom. He looked around at the sea of faces, and it was obvious they had been waiting for him. Joan typed a search string into the computer. Attempt on Zerimsky's life. What press reports there were all seemed to agree on one thing, that the man who had been arrested in Freedom Square was Pete de Villiers, a South African hitman hired by the Russian mafia to assassinate Zerimsky. A rifle discovered among his belongings was identified as identical to that which had been used to assassinate Ricardo Guzman, a presidential candidate in Colombia, 2 months earlier. Joan scanned the Turkish newspaper's line drawing of de Villiers into her computer and enlarged it until it filled the entire screen. She then zoomed in on the eyes and blew them up to life size. She was now certain of the true identity of the man about to go on trial in St. Petersburg. Joan checked her watch. It was a few minutes past 2. She picked up the phone by her side and dialed a number she knew by heart. It rang for some time before a sleepy voice answered, "Who's this?" Joan said only, "It's important that I see you. I'll be at your place in a little over an hour," and replaced the phone. A few moments later, someone else was woken by a ringing telephone. He listened carefully before saying, "We'll just have to advance our original schedule by a few days." Connor stood in the dock and looked around the courtroom. His eyes first settled on the jury. 12 good men and true? Unlikely. Not one of them even glanced in his direction. He suspected that it hadn't taken long to swear them in, and that there wouldn't have been any requests for alternates. Everyone in the courtroom rose as a man in a long black gown emerged from a side door. He sat down in the large leather chair in the center of the raised dais, below a full-length portrait of President Zerimsky. The clerk of the court rose from his place and read out the charge, in Russian. Connor was barely able to follow the proceedings, and he certainly wasn't asked how he wished to plead. The clerk resumed his seat, and a tall, somber-looking middle-aged man rose from the bench directly below the judge and began to address the jury. Holding the lapels of his jacket, the prosecutor spent the rest of the morning describing the events that had led up to the arrest of the defendant. He told the jury how de Villiers had been stalking Zerimsky for several days before he was apprehended in Freedom Square, and how the rifle with which the defendant had intended to assassinate their beloved president had been discovered among his personal belongings in a hotel lobby. "Vanity got the better of the accused," the prosecutor said. "The case that contained the weapon had his initials clearly printed on it." The judge allowed the rifle and the briefcase to be examined by the jury. "Even more damning, a slip of paper was found secreted in the accused's sponge bag," continued the prosecutor, "which confirmed the transfer of $1 million to a numbered bank account in Geneva." Again, the jury was given the chance to study this piece of evidence. The prosecutor went on to praise the diligence and resourcefulness of the St. Petersburg police force for preventing this heinous act, and its professionalism in catching the criminal who had intended to perpetrate it. He added that the nation owed a considerable debt of gratitude to Vladimir Bolchenkov, the city's chief of police. Several members of the jury nodded their agreement. The prosecutor completed his monologue by informing the jury that whenever the defendant had been asked if he had been hired to carry out the killing on behalf of the mafia, he had refused to answer. "You must make what you will of his silence," he said. "My own conclusion is that having heard the evidence, there can only be one verdict and one sentence." He smiled thinly at the judge and resumed his seat. Connor looked around the courtroom to see who had been appointed to defend him. He wondered how his counsel would go about the task when they hadn't even met. The judge nodded towards the other end of the bench, and a young man who looked as if he hadn't long been out of law school rose to address the court. He did not clasp the lapels of his jacket as he looked up towards the bench, or smile at the judge, or even address the jury. He simply said, "My client offers no defense," and resumed his seat. The judge nodded, then turned his attention to the foreman of the jury, a grave-looking man who knew exactly what was expected of him. He rose from his place on cue.
"Having listened to the evidence in this case, Mr. Foreman, how do you find the defendant?"
"Guilty," said the man, delivering his one-word script without needing to be prompted or to consult any other member of the jury. The judge looked at Connor for the first time.
"As the jury has reached the unanimous verdict, all that is left for me to do is pass sentence, and by statute there is only one penalty for your crime."
He paused, stared impassively at Connor, and said, "I sentence you to death by hanging." The judge turned to the defense counsel.
"Do you wish to appeal against the sentence?"
he asked rhetorically.
"No, sir,"
came back the immediate response.
"The execution will take place at 8 a.m. on Friday."
Connor was surprised, only that they were waiting until Friday to hang him.
This ends Disc 5. The 11th Commandment, Disc 6.
Before she left, Joan checked over several of the articles again. The dates exactly matched Connor's absences abroad. First the trip to Colombia, then the visit to St. Petersburg. There were, to quote one of Connor's favorite maxims, just too many coincidences. By 3 o'clock, Joan felt drained and exhausted. She didn't look forward to telling Maggie the results of her detective work. And if it really was Connor on trial in St. Petersburg, there wasn't a moment to waste, because the Turkish papers were already a couple of days old. Joan shut down her computer, locked her desk, and hoped her boss wouldn't notice that his email inbox was almost empty. She walked up the old staircase to the ground floor, inserted her electric passkey in the exit security control, and passed the trickle of workers arriving for the early morning shift. Joan switched on her headlights and drove her brand new car out of the parking lot and through the gate, turning east onto the George Washington Parkway. The road was still covered with patchy ice from the previous evening's storm, and highway crews were working to clear it before the morning rush hour. Normally, she enjoyed driving through Washington's deserted early morning streets, past the magnificent monuments that commemorated the nation's history. At school in St. Paul, she had sat silently at the front of the class while her teacher regaled them with tales of Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Roosevelt. It was her admiration for these heroic figures that had fueled her ambition to work in the public service. After studying government at the University of Minnesota, she had filled in application forms for the FBI and the CIA. Both had asked to interview her, but once she had seen Connor Fitzgerald, she had canceled her appointment with the FBI. Here was a man who had returned from a futile war with a medal he never mentioned, and who continued to serve his country without fanfare or recognition. If she ever expressed these thoughts to Connor, he only laughed and told her she was being sentimental. But Tom Lawrence had been right when he had described Connor as one of the nation's unsung heroes. Joan would suggest to Maggie that she contact the White House immediately, as it was Lawrence who had asked Connor to take on this assignment in the first place. Joan was trying to put her thoughts into some logical order when a large green sanding truck passed her on the outside and began moving across into her lane moments before it had fully overtaken her. She flashed her lights, but the truck didn't pull away as she expected. She checked her rearview mirror and eased into the center lane. The truck immediately began to drift across into her path, forcing her to veer sharply into the left-hand lane. Joan had to decide in an instant whether to slam on her brakes or try to accelerate past the thoughtless driver. Once again, she checked her rearview mirror, but this time she was horrified to see a large black Mercedes coming up fast behind her. She slammed her foot down on the accelerator as the highway banked steeply to the left near Spout Run. The little Passat responded immediately, but the sanding truck also accelerated, and she couldn't pick up enough speed to pass it. Joan had no choice but to move further to her left, almost into the median strip. She looked into her rearview mirror and saw that the Mercedes had also drifted across and was now close to her rear bumper. She could feel her heart pounding. Were the truck and the car working together? She tried to slow down, but the Mercedes just moved closer and closer to her rear bumper. Joan slammed her foot down on the accelerator again, and her car leapt forward. Sweat was running down her forehead and into her eyes as she drew level with the front of the sanding truck, but even with her foot flat on the floor, she just couldn't overtake it. She stared up into the cab and tried to attract the driver's attention, but he ignored her waving hand and went on implacably easing the truck inch by inch further to his left, forcing her to slow down and fall in behind him. She checked her rearview mirror. The Mercedes was, if anything, even closer to her bumper. As she looked forward, the truck's tailplate rose, and its load of sand began to pour out onto the road. Instinctively, Joan slammed on her brakes, but the little car careened out of control, skidded across the ice-encrusted median strip, and hurled down the grass embankment towards the river. It hit the water like a flat stone, and after floating for a moment, disappeared out of sight. All that was left were the skid marks on the bank and a few bubbles. The sanding truck moved back into the center lane and continued its journey in the direction of Washington. A moment later, the Mercedes flashed its lights, overtook the truck, and accelerated away. Two cars that were heading towards Dulles Airport came to a halt on the median strip. One of the drivers leaped out and slid down the bank towards the river to see if he could help, but by the time he reached the water, there was no sign of the car. The other driver scribbled down the sanding truck's license number. He handed it to the first cop to arrive on the scene, who punched it into his dashboard computer. After a few seconds, he frowned. "Are you sure you wrote down the correct number, sir?" he asked. "The Washington Highway Department has no record of such a vehicle." When Connor was bundled into the back of the car, he found the chief of police waiting for him once again. As the driver began the return journey to the crucifix, Connor couldn't resist asking Bolchenkov a question. "I'm puzzled to know why they're waiting until Friday to hang me." "Bit of luck, really," said the chief. "It seems our beloved president insisted on witnessing the execution." Bolchenkov inhaled deeply on his cigarette. "And he doesn't have a spare 15 minutes in his schedule before Friday morning." Connor gave a wry smile. "I'm glad you found your tongue at last, Mr. Fitzgerald," continued the chief, "because I think the time has come to let you know that there is an alternative." Chapter 21. Mark Twain once said of a friend, "If he didn't turn up on time, you would know he was dead." Once 4 o'clock had come and gone, Maggie started checking her watch every few minutes. By 4:30, she began to wonder if she had been so sleepy when Joan called that she might have misunderstood what she had said. At 5 o'clock, Maggie decided it was time to give Joan a call at home. No answer, just a continual ringing tone. Next, she tried her car phone, and this time she did get a message. "This number is temporarily out of order. Please try again later." Maggie began pacing around the kitchen table, feeling sure that Joan must have some news of Connor. It had to be important, otherwise why would she have woken her at 2 in the morning? Had he been in contact with her? Did she know where he was? Would she be able to tell her when he was coming home? By 6, Maggie had decided it was now an emergency. She switched on the television to check the exact time. Charlie Gibson's face appeared on the screen. In the next hour, we'll talk about Christmas decorations that even the kids can help you with. But first, we'll go over to Kevin Newman for this morning's news. Maggie began pacing around the kitchen as a reporter predicted that the president's nuclear, biological, chemical, and conventional arms reduction bill was almost certain to be voted down in the Senate now that Zelensky had been elected as the Russian leader. She was wondering if she should break a lifetime's rule and try to ring Joan at Langley when a trailer appeared under Kevin Newman's image. GW Parkway crash involved sanding truck and Volkswagen. Driver of car presumed drowned. Details on Eyewitness News at 6:30. The words crawled across the screen and disappeared. Maggie tried to eat a bowl of cornflakes while the early morning bulletin continued. Andy Lloyd appeared on the screen, announcing that President Zelensky would be making an official visit to Washington just before Christmas. "The president welcomed the news," said a reporter, "and hoped it would go some way to convincing Senate leaders that the new Russian president wished to remain on friendly terms with America. However, the majority leader of the Senate said he would wait until Zelensky had addressed." When Maggie heard the little thud on the mat, she went out into the hall, picked up the 7 envelopes lying on the floor, and checked through them as she walked back into the kitchen. 4 were for Connor. She never opened his letters while he was away. 1 was a Pepco bill, another was postmarked Chicago, and the letter E on Maggie was at an angle, so it could only have been Declan O'Casey's annual Christmas card. The last letter bore the distinctive handwriting of her daughter. She tossed the others to one side and tore it open. "Dear Mother, just a note to confirm that Stuart arrives in Los Angeles on Friday. We plan to drive up to San Francisco for a few days before flying to Washington on the 15th. Maggie smiled. "We're both looking forward to spending Christmas with you and Dad. He hasn't phoned me, so I assume he isn't back yet." Maggie frowned. "I've had a letter from Joan who doesn't seem to be enjoying her new job. I suspect that, like all of us, she is missing Dad. She tells me she is buying a sexy new Volkswagen." Maggie read the sentence a second time before her hand began trembling. "Oh, my God, no," she said out loud. She checked her watch. 6:20. On the television, Lisa McCree was holding up a paper chain of holly and berries. "Festive Christmas decorations the children can help with," she declared brightly. "Now we turn to the topic of Christmas trees." Maggie flicked over to Channel 5. Another newscaster was speculating about whether Zelensky's planned visit would influence Senate leaders before they cast their vote on the arms reduction bill. "Come on, come on," said Maggie. Finally, the newscaster said, "And now we have more on that accident on the George Washington Parkway. We go live to our on-the-spot correspondent, Liz Fullerton." "Thank you, Julie. I'm standing on the median of the George Washington Parkway where the tragic accident took place at approximately 3:15 this morning. Earlier, I interviewed an eyewitness who told Channel 5 what he had seen." The camera focused on a man who clearly hadn't expected to be on television that morning. "I was headed into Washington," he told the reporter, "when this sanding truck deposited its load on the highway, causing the car behind to swerve and run out of control. The car skidded right across the road, down the bank, and into the Potomac." The camera swung across to show a wide angle of the river, focusing on a group of police divers before returning to the reporter. "No one seems to be quite sure exactly what happened," she continued. "It's even possible that the driver of the sanding truck, sitting high up in his cab, continued on his journey unaware that an accident had taken place." "No, no," screamed Maggie. "Don't let it be her." "Behind me you can see police divers who have already located the vehicle, apparently a Volkswagen Passat. They hope to bring it to the surface within the next hour. The identity of the driver is still unknown."
"No, no, no," repeated Maggie. "Please, God, not Joan."
"The police are requesting that the driver of a black Mercedes who may have witnessed the accident should come forward to help with their inquiries. We hope to bring you more news on the hour, so until then..."
Maggie ran into the hall, grabbed her coat, and rushed out of the front door. She leapt into her car and was relieved when the old Toyota spluttered into life almost immediately. She eased it slowly out onto Avon Place before accelerating down 29th Street and east on M Street in the direction of the parkway. If she had checked her rearview mirror, she would have seen a small blue Ford making a three-point turn before chasing after her. The passenger in the front seat was dialing an unlisted number.
Mr. Jackson, it's so good of you to come and see me again.
Jackson was amused by Nikolai Romanov's elaborate courtesy, especially as it carried with it the pretense that he might have had some choice in the matter. The first meeting had been at Jackson's request, and obviously hadn't been considered a waste of time, as Sergei was still running around on both legs. Each subsequent meeting had followed a summons from Romanov to bring Jackson up to date with the latest plans. The Tsar sank back in his winged chair, and Jackson noticed the usual glass of colorless liquid on the table by his side. He remembered the old man's reaction on the one occasion he had asked a question, and waited for him to speak.
"You'll be glad to hear, Mr. Jackson, that with the exception of a single problem that still needs to be resolved, everything required to make good your colleague's escape has been arranged. All we need now is for Mr. Fitzgerald to agree to our terms. Should he find himself unable to do so, I can do nothing to prevent him from being hanged at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning."
Romanov spoke without feeling.
"Allow me to take you through what we have planned so far, should he decide to go ahead. I am certain that as a former deputy director of the CIA, your observations will prove useful."
The old man pressed a button in the armrest of his chair, and the doors at the far end of the drawing room opened immediately. Alexei Romanov entered the room.
"I believe you know my son," said the Tsar.
Jackson glanced in the direction of the man who always accompanied him on his journeys to the Winter Palace, but rarely spoke. He nodded. The young man pushed aside an exquisite 14th-century tapestry depicting the Battle of Flanders. Behind it was concealed a large television set. The flat silver screen looked somewhat incongruous in such magnificent surroundings, but no more so, Jackson thought, than its owner and his acolytes. The first image to come up on the screen was an exterior shot of the crucifix prison. Alexei Romanov pointed to the entrance.
"Zerimsky is expected to arrive at the jail at 7:50. He will be in the third of seven cars and will enter through a side gate situated here."
His finger moved across the screen.
"He will be met by Vladimir Bolchenkov, who will accompany him into the main courtyard where the execution will take place, at 7:52.
The young Romanov continued to take Jackson through the plan, minute by minute, going into even greater detail when it came to explaining how Connor's escape would be achieved. Jackson noticed that he seemed unconcerned by the one remaining problem, obviously confident that his father would come up with a solution before the following morning. When he had finished, Alexei switched off the television, replaced the tapestry, and gave his father a slight bow. He then left the room without another word. When the door had closed, the old man asked,
"Do you have any observations?"
"One or two," said Jackson. "First, let me say that I'm impressed by the plan and convinced it has every chance of succeeding. It's obvious you've thought of almost every contingency that might arise. That is, assuming Connor agrees to your terms. And on that, I must repeat, I have no authority to speak on his behalf." Romanov nodded. "But you're still facing one problem."
"And do you have a solution?"
asked the old man. "Yes," replied Jackson. "I have." Bolchenkov spent nearly an hour spelling out Romanov's plan in great detail, then left Connor to consider his response. He didn't need to be reminded that he was faced with an unalterable time limit. Zerimsky was due to arrive at the crucifix in 45 minutes.
Connor lay on his bunk. The terms couldn't have been expressed more explicitly, but even if he did accept those terms and his escape was successfully engineered, he wasn't at all confident that he would be able to carry out his side of the bargain. If he failed, they would kill him. It was that simple. Except that Bolchenkov had promised that it would not be the quick and easy death of the hangman's noose. He had also spelled out, in case Connor should be in any doubt, that all contracts made with the Russian mafia and not honored automatically became the responsibility of the offender's next of kin. Connor could still see the cynical expression on the chief's face as he extracted the photographs from an inside pocket and passed them over to him.
"Two fine women,"
Bolchenkov had said.
"You must be proud of them. It would be a tragedy to have to shorten their lives for something they knew nothing about."
15 minutes later, the cell door swung open again, and Bolchenkov returned, an unlit cigarette dangling from his mouth. This time he didn't sit down. Connor continued to look up at the ceiling as if he wasn't there.
"I see that our little proposal is still presenting you with a dilemma," said the chief, lighting the cigarette. "Even after our brief acquaintance, that does not surprise me. But perhaps when you hear my latest piece of news, you will change your mind."
Connor went on gazing at the ceiling.
"It appears that your former secretary, Joan Bennett, has met with an unfortunate car accident. She was on her way from Langley to visit your wife."
Connor swung his legs off the bed, sat up and stared at Bolchenkov. "If Joan is dead, how could you possibly know she was on her way to see my wife?"
"The CIA aren't the only people who are tapping your wife's telephone," replied the chief.
He took a last drag from his cigarette, allowed the stub to fall from his mouth, and ground it out on the floor.
"We suspect that your secretary had somehow discovered who it was that we arrested in Freedom Square, and without putting too fine a point on it, if your wife is as proud and headstrong as her profile suggests, I think we can assume that it won't be long before she reaches the same conclusion. If that is the case, I fear Mrs. Fitzgerald is destined to suffer the same fate as your late secretary."
"If I agree to Romanov's terms," Connor said, "I wish to insert a clause of my own into the contract." Bolchenkov listened with interest. "Mr. Guttenberg?"
"Speaking."
"This is Maggie Fitzgerald. I'm the wife of Connor Fitzgerald, who I believe is currently abroad on an assignment for you."
"I don't recall the name," said Guttenberg.
"You attended his farewell party at our home in Georgetown only a couple of weeks ago."
"I think you must have mistaken me for someone else," replied Guttenberg calmly.
"I have not mistaken you for anyone else, Mr. Guttenberg. In fact, at 8:27 on the 2nd of November, you made a phone call from my home to your office."
"I made no such call, Mrs. Fitzgerald, and I can assure you that your husband has never worked for me."
"Then tell me, Mr. Guttenberg, did Joan Bennett ever work for the agency, or has she also been conveniently erased from your memory?" "What are you suggesting, Mrs. Fitzgerald?" "Ah, I've caught your attention at last. Allow me to repair your temporary loss of memory. Joan Bennett was my husband's secretary for nearly 20 years, and I have a feeling you would find it hard to deny that you knew she was on her way from Langley to see me when she met her death."
"I was sorry to read of Miss Bennett's tragic accident, but I'm at a loss to understand what it has to do with me."
"The press are apparently mystified about what actually took place on the George Washington Parkway yesterday morning, but they might be a step nearer to the solution if they were told that Joan Bennett used to work for a man who has disappeared from the face of the earth while carrying out a special assignment for you. I've always found in the past that journalists consider a story involving a Medal of Honor winner to be of interest to their readers."
"Mrs. Fitzgerald, I can't be expected to remember every one of the 17,000 people the CIA employs, and I certainly don't recall ever meeting Miss Bennett, let alone your husband."
"I see I'll have to jog that failing memory of yours a little further, Mr. Guttenberg. As it happens, the party you didn't attend and didn't telephone from was, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, videotaped by my daughter.
She'd hoped to surprise her father by giving him the tape for Christmas. I've just had another look at it, Mr. Guttenberg, and although you play only a minor role, I can assure you that your tête-à-tête with Joan Bennett is there for all to see. This conversation is also being recorded, and I have a feeling that the networks will consider your contribution worth airing on the early evening news. This time Guttenberg didn't reply for some time. "Perhaps it might be a good idea for us to meet, Mrs. Fitzgerald," he said eventually. "I can see no purpose in that, Mr. Guttenberg. I already know exactly what I require from you." "And what is that, Mrs. Fitzgerald?" "I want to know where my husband is at this moment, and when I can expect to see him again. In return for those two simple pieces of information, I will hand over the tape."
"I'll need a little time."
"Of course you will," said Maggie. "Shall we say 48 hours? And, Mr. Guttenberg, don't waste your time tearing my home apart searching for the tape, because you won't find it. It's been hidden somewhere that even a mind as devious as yours wouldn't think of."
"But,"
began Guttenberg, "I should also add that if you decide to dispose of me in the same way you did Joan Bennett, I've instructed my lawyers that if I die in suspicious circumstances, they are to immediately release copies of the tape to all three major networks, Fox and CNN. If, on the other hand, I simply disappear, the tape will be released 7 days later. Goodbye, Mr. Guttenberg." Maggie put the phone down and collapsed under the bed, bathed in sweat. Guttenberg shot through the connecting door between his office and the director's. Helen Dexter glanced up from her desk, unable to hide her surprise that her deputy had entered the room without bothering to knock. "We have a problem," was all he said. Chapter 22. The condemned man ate no breakfast. The kitchen staff always made an effort to remove the lice from the bread for a prisoner's last meal, but this time they had failed. He took one look at the offering and put the tin plate under his bunk. A few minutes later, a Russian Orthodox priest entered the cell. He explained that although he was not of the same denomination as the prisoner, he would be happy to perform the last rites. The Holy Sacrament was the only food he would eat that day. After the priest had performed the little ceremony, they knelt together on the cold stone floor. At the end of a short prayer, the priest blessed him and left him to his solitude. He lay on his bunk, staring up at the ceiling, not for one moment regretting his decision. Once he had explained his reasons, Bolchenkov had accepted them without comment, even nodding curtly as he left the cell. It was the nearest the chief would ever get to admitting that he admired a man's moral courage. The prisoner had faced the prospect of death once before. It didn't hold the same horror for him a second time. On that occasion, he had thought about his wife and the child he would never see, but now he could only think of his parents, who had died within a few days of each other. He was glad that neither of them had gone to their graves with this as their final memory of him. For them, his return from Vietnam had been a triumph, and they were delighted when he had told them that he intended to go on serving his country. He might even have become director if a president in trouble hadn't decided to appoint a woman in the hope that it would help his flagging campaign. It hadn't. Although it was Guttenberg who had placed the knife firmly between his shoulder blades, there wasn't any doubt about who had handed him the weapon. She would have enjoyed playing Lady Macbeth. He would go to his grave knowing that few of his fellow countrymen would ever be aware of the sacrifice he had made. For him, that only made it all the more worthwhile. There would be no ceremonial farewell, no coffin draped with the American flag, no friends and relatives standing by the graveside to hear the priest extolling the dedication and public service which had been the hallmark of his career. No Marines raising their rifles proudly in the air, no 21-gun salute, no folded flag given on behalf of the president to his next of kin. No, he was destined to be just another of Tom Lawrence's unsung heroes. For him, all that was left was to be hanged by the neck in an unloved and unloving land, a shaven head, a number on his wrist, and an unmarked grave. Why had he made that decision which had so moved the usually passionless chief of police?
He didn't have time to explain to him what had taken place in Vietnam, but that was where the die had been irrevocably cast. Perhaps he should have faced the firing squad all those years ago in another far-off land, but he had survived. This time, there was no one to rescue him at the last moment, and it was too late now to change his mind. The Russian president woke in a foul mood that morning. The first person he took it out on was his chef. He swept his breakfast onto the floor and shouted, "Is this the sort of hospitality I can expect when I come to Leningrad?" He stormed out of the room. In his study, a nervous official placed on his desk documents for signing which would empower the police to arrest citizens without having to charge them with any crime. This did nothing to change Zarimsky's black mood. He knew that it was merely a ploy to get a few pickpockets, dope peddlers, and petty criminals off the streets. It was the Tsar's head he wanted delivered to him on a platter. If the Minister for the Interior continued to fail him, he would have to consider replacing him. By the time his chief of staff arrived, Zarimsky had signed away the lives of another 100 men whose only crime had been to support Chernopov during the election campaign. Rumors were already circulating around Moscow that the former prime minister planned to emigrate. The day he left the country, Zarimsky would sign 1,000 such orders and would imprison everybody who had ever served Chernopov in any capacity. He threw his pen down on the desk. All this had been achieved in less than a week. The thought of the havoc he was going to cause in a month, a year, made him feel a little more cheerful.
"Your limousine is waiting, Mr. President," said a petrified official whose face he couldn't see.
He smiled at the thought of what would undoubtedly be the highlight of his day. He had been looking forward to a morning at the crucifix, as others would anticipate an evening at the Kirov. He left his study and strode down the long marble corridor of the newly commandeered office block towards the open door, his entourage moving swiftly ahead of him. He paused for a moment on the top step to look down at the gleaming motorcade. He had instructed party officials that he must always have one more limousine than any previous president. He climbed into the back of the third car and checked his watch. 7:43. The police had cleared the road an hour before so that the motorcade could proceed without encountering a single vehicle traveling in either direction. "Holding up the traffic makes the local inhabitants aware that the president is in town," he explained to his chief of staff. The traffic police estimated that the journey, which would normally have taken 20 minutes, should be completed in less than 7. As Zarimsky shot through traffic lights of whatever color and swung across the river, he didn't even glance in the direction of the Hermitage. Once they reached the other side of the Neva, the driver of the leading car pushed the speedometer up to 100 kilometers an hour to be sure the president would be on time for his first official engagement that morning. As he lay on his bunk, the prisoner could hear the guards marching down the stone passageway towards him, the noise of their boots becoming a little louder with each step. He wondered how many of them there would be. They stopped outside his cell. A key turned in the lock and the door swung open. When you have only moments to live, you notice every detail. Bolchenkov led them in. The prisoner was impressed that he had got back so quickly. He lit a cigarette and inhaled once before offering it to the prisoner. He shook his head. The chief shrugged his shoulders, ground the cigarette out on the stone floor with his foot, and left to greet the president. The next person to enter the cell was the priest. He was carrying a large, open Bible and softly chanting some words that meant nothing to the prisoner. Next were three men he recognized immediately, but this time there was no razor, no needle, just a pair of handcuffs. They stared at him, almost willing him to put up a fight, but to their disappointment he calmly placed his hands behind his back and waited. They slapped on the cuffs and pushed him out of the cell into the corridor. At the end of the long gray tunnel, he could just make out a pinprick of sunlight. The president stepped out of his limousine to be welcomed by the chief of police. It amused him that he had awarded Bolchenkov the Order of Lenin on the same day as he had signed an order to arrest his brother. Bolchenkov led Zarimsky into the yard where the execution would take place. No one suggested removing the president's fur-lined coat or hat on such a bitterly cold morning. As they crossed the courtyard, the small crowd, huddled up against one wall, began to applaud. The chief saw a frown cross Zarimsky's face. The president had expected far more people to turn up to witness the execution of a man who had been sent to kill him. Bolchenkov had anticipated that this might present a problem, so he leaned over and whispered in the president's ear, "I was instructed to permit only party members to attend." Zarimsky nodded. Bolchenkov didn't add how difficult it had been to drag even the few people present into the crucifix that morning. Too many of them had heard the stories of how, once you were in, you never got out. The chief came to a halt by a plush 18th-century chair that Catherine the Great had bought from the estate of the British Prime Minister Robert Walpole in 1779, and that had been requisitioned from the Hermitage that previous day. The president sank into the comfortable seat directly in front of the newly erected gallows. After only a few seconds, Zarimsky began fidgeting impatiently as he waited for the prisoner to appear. He looked across at the crowd, and his eyes rested on a young boy who was crying. It didn't please him. At that moment, the prisoner emerged from the dark corridor into the stark morning light. The bald head, covered in dried blood, and the thin, gray prison uniform made him look strangely anonymous. He appeared remarkably calm for someone who had only a few more moments to live. The condemned man stared up into the morning sun and shivered as an officer of the guard marched forward, grabbed his left wrist, and checked the number, 12995. The officer then turned to face the president and read out the court order. While the officer went through the formalities, the prisoner looked around the yard. He saw the shivering crowd, most of them wary of moving a muscle for fear that they might be ordered to join him. His eyes settled on the boy who was still weeping. If they had allowed him to make a will, he would have left everything to that child. He glanced briefly at the scaffold and settled his gaze on the president. Their eyes met. Although he was terrified, the prisoner held Zarimsky's gaze. He was determined not to let him have the satisfaction of knowing just how frightened he was. If the president had stopped staring back at him and looked down at the ground between his feet, he would have seen for himself. The officer, having completed his commission, rolled up his scroll and marched away. This was the sign for two of the thugs to come forward, grab one of the prisoner's arms each, and lead him to the scaffold. He walked calmly past the president and on towards the gallows. When he reached the first of the wooden steps, he glanced up at the clock tower, 8:03. Few people, he thought, ever know exactly how long they have left to live. He almost willed the clock to strike. He had waited 28 years to repay his debt. Now, in these final moments, it all came back to him. It had been a hot, sweaty May morning in Nandin. Someone had to be made an example of, and as the senior officer, he had been singled out. His second in command had stepped forward and volunteered to take his place, and, like the coward he was, he had not protested. The Viet Cong officer had laughed and accepted the offer, but then decided that both men should face the firing squad the following morning. In the middle of the night, the same lieutenant had come to his bedside and said they must try to escape. They would never have another chance. Security at the camp was always lax, because to the north lay 100 miles of jungle occupied by the Viet Cong, and to the south 25 miles of impenetrable swamp. Several men had tried their luck with that route before, and their luck had run out. The lieutenant said he would rather risk dying in the swamps than face the certainty of death by firing squad. As he stole away into the night, the captain had reluctantly joined him. When the sun appeared above the horizon a few hours later, the camp was still within sight. Across the stinking, mosquito-infested swamp, they could hear the guards laughing as they took turns to fire potshots at them. They had dived below the surface of the swamp, but after only a few seconds, they had to come up and struggle on. Eventually, after the longest day of his life, darkness fell. He had begged the lieutenant to carry on without him, but he had refused. By the end of the second day, he wished he had been allowed to face the firing squad instead of dying in that godforsaken swamp in that godforsaken country. But on and on the young officer went. For 11 days and 12 nights they didn't eat, surviving only by drinking from the endless torrents of rain. On the 12th morning they reached dry land, and, delirious from illness and exhaustion, he collapsed. He later learned that for 4 more days the lieutenant had carried him through the jungle to safety. The next thing he recalled was waking in an army hospital. "How long have I been here?" he asked the nurse who was tending him. 6 days, she said. "You're lucky to be alive." "And my friend? He's been up for the past couple of days. He's already visited you once this morning." He fell asleep again, and when he woke, he asked the nurse for a pen and paper. He spent the rest of the day sitting in his hospital bed, writing and rewriting the citation. When he had made a fair copy, he asked that it should be sent to the commanding officer. 6 months later, he had stood on the White House lawn between Maggie and her father and had listened to the citation being read out. Lieutenant Connor Fitzgerald stepped forward, and the president had awarded him the Medal of Honor. As he began to mount the steps of the gallows, he thought of the one man who would mourn him when he discovered the truth. He had warned them not to tell him because if he found out, he would break the contract, give himself up, and return to the crucifix. "You must understand," he had explained to them, "that you are dealing with a totally honorable man. So be sure that the clock has struck 8 before he finds out he's been deceived." The first chime sent a shiver through his body, and his thoughts were brought back to the moment. On the second chime, the little boy who had been crying ran up to the foot of the gallows and fell on his knees. On the third, the chief placed a restraining arm on a young corporal who had taken a step forward to drag the child away. On the fourth, the prisoner smiled down at Sergei as if he were his only son. On the fifth, the two thugs pushed him forward so that he was standing directly below the dangling rope. On the sixth, the hangman placed the noose around his neck. On the seventh, he lowered his eyes and stared directly at the president of the Russian Republic. On the eighth, the hangman pulled the lever and the trapdoor opened. As the body of Christopher Andrew Jackson swung above him, Zerimsky began to applaud. Some of the crowd half-heartedly joined in. A minute later, the two thugs carried the lifeless body down from the gallows. Sergei rushed forward to help them lower his friend into the crude wooden coffin that lay on the ground beside the scaffold. The chief accompanied the president back to his limousine, and the motorcade sped out of the prison gates even before the coffin lid had been nailed down. 4 prisoners lifted the heavy casket onto their shoulders and headed towards the graveyard. Sergei walked by their side out of the yard to a patch of rough ground at the back of the prison. Even the dead were not allowed to escape from the crucifix. If Sergei had looked back, he would have seen the rest of the crowd running out through the prison gates before they were slammed shut and the vast wooden bolts pushed back in place. The pallbearers stopped by the side of an unmarked grave that other prisoners had just finished digging. They dropped the casket unceremoniously into the gaping hole and then, without a prayer or even a moment's pause, shoveled the recently dug sods of earth on top of it. The boy didn't move until they had completed their task. A few minutes later, the guards herded the prisoners back to their cells. Sergei fell on his knees, wondering how long they would allow him to remain by the grave. A moment later, a hand was placed on the boy's shoulder. He looked up and saw the chief standing above him. "A fair man," he'd once told Jackson. "Did you know him well?" the chief asked.
"Yes, sir," said Sergei. "He was my partner."
The chief nodded. "I knew the man he gave his life for," he said. "I only wish I had such a friend." Chapter 23. "Mrs. Fitzgerald is not quite as clever as she thinks she is," said Guttenberg. "Amateurs rarely are," said Helen Dexter. "Does that mean you've got hold of the video?" "No, although I've got a pretty good idea where it is," said Guttenberg. He paused. "But not exactly where." "Stop being a smartass," said Dexter, "and get to the point. You don't need to prove to me how clever you are." Guttenberg knew that this was about as near as he would ever get to receiving a compliment from the director. "Mrs. Fitzgerald doesn't realize that her home and office have been bugged for the past month, and that we've had agents watching her since the day her husband flew out of Dulles 3 weeks ago. So, what have you found out? Not a lot, when the individual bits of information are taken in isolation. But if you piece them together, they start making a picture." He pushed a file and a tape recorder across the table. The director ignored them. "Talk me through it," she said, beginning to sound a little irritated. "During Mrs. Fitzgerald's lunch with Joan Bennett at the Café Milano, the conversation was inconsequential until just before she left to return to work. It was then that she asked Bennett a question."
"And what was the question? Perhaps you'd like to hear for yourself."
The deputy director pressed the play button on the tape recorder and sat back.
"Me too. Black, no sugar."
Footsteps could be heard walking away. "Joan, I've never asked you to break a confidence before, but there's something I have to know." "I hope I can help. But as I've already explained, if it concerns Connor, I'm probably as much in the dark as you are."
"Then I need the name of someone who isn't in the dark."
There followed a long silence before Joan said, "I suggest you look at the guest list for Connor's farewell party."
"Chris Jackson?"
"No. Unfortunately, he's no longer employed by the company." There was another long silence.
"That smooth little man who left without saying goodbye, the one who said he worked in loss adjustment?"
Guttenberg flicked off the tape.
"Why did you ever go to that party?" snapped Dexter.
"Because you instructed me to find out if Fitzgerald had landed a job that would keep him in Washington. Don't forget that it was his daughter who gave us the lead that made it possible to convince Thompson that it might not be wise to employ him. I'm sure you recall the circumstances."
The director frowned.
"What happened after Mrs. Fitzgerald left the Café Milano?"
"Nothing significant until she returned home that night when she made several calls. She never makes personal calls from the office, including one to Chris Jackson's cell phone."
"Why would she do that, when she knew he'd left the company?"
"And they go back a long way. He and Fitzgerald served in Vietnam together. In fact, it was Jackson who recommended Fitzgerald for the Medal of Honor and who recruited him as an NOC.
"Did Jackson tell her about you?" asked Dexter in disbelief.
"No, he didn't have a chance," replied Guttenberg. "I gave an order to block his cell phone the moment we discovered he was in Russia."
He smiled. "We can, however, still identify who's been trying to call him and who he's been trying to call."
"Does that mean you've found out who he's reporting back to?"
"Jackson has only dialed one number on that line since he landed in Russia, and I suspect he only risked that because it was an emergency."
"Who did he call?" asked Dexter impatiently.
"An unlisted number at the White House?"
Dexter didn't even blink.
"Our friend Mr. Lloyd, no doubt."
"No doubt," replied Guttenberg.
"Is Mrs. Fitzgerald aware that Jackson is reporting directly to the White House?"
"I don't think so," said Guttenberg. "Otherwise, I suspect she would have tried to contact him herself some time ago."
Dexter nodded. "Then we must make certain that she never finds out."
Guttenberg showed no emotion.
"Understood. But I can't do anything about that until I've got my hands on the family video."
"What's the latest status on that?" asked Dexter.
"We wouldn't have progressed an inch if we hadn't picked up a clue in an intercepted phone call. When Joan Bennett rang Mrs. Fitzgerald from Langley at 2 in the morning to say she'd be with her in an hour, one of my people checked what she'd been calling up on the reference library's computer. It soon became clear that she must have stumbled on something that made her suspect it was her old boss who was in prison in St. Petersburg. But as you know, she never kept her appointment with Mrs. Fitzgerald."
"A little too close for comfort."
"Agreed. But when she failed to turn up, Mrs. Fitzgerald drove out to the G.W. Parkway and waited for the police to dredge up the car."
"She probably saw a report on TV or heard about it on the radio," said Dexter.
"Yes, that's what we assumed. The story led the local news that morning. Once she knew for certain it was Bennett in the car, she immediately phoned her daughter at Stanford. If she sounds a little sleepy, that's because it was only 5 o'clock in the morning in California."
He leant forward again.
and touched the play button on the tape recorder. "Hi, Tara. It's Mom."
"Hi, Mom. What time is it?
I'm sorry to call so early, darling, but I have some very sad news."
"Not Dad?"
"No. Joan Bennett. She's been killed in a car crash."
"Joan's dead? I can't believe it. Tell me it's not true."
"I'm afraid it is. And I have a terrible feeling that in some way it's connected to the reason Connor hasn't returned home."
"Come on, Mom. Aren't you getting a little paranoid? After all, Dad's only been away for 3 weeks."
"You may be right. But I've still decided to move that video you made of his farewell party to a safer place."
"Why?"
"Because it's the only proof I have that your father ever met a man called Nick Guttenberg, let alone worked for him." The deputy director touched the stop button. The conversation continues for some time, but it doesn't add a great deal to our knowledge. When Mrs. Fitzgerald left the house a few minutes later carrying a videotape, the officer listening in realized the significance of what he just heard and tailed her to the university. She didn't go straight to the admissions office as usual, but dropped in at the library where she went to the computer section on the first floor. She spent 20 minutes searching for something on one of the computers and left with a printout of about a dozen pages. Then she took the elevator down to the audiovisual research center on the ground floor. The officer didn't want to risk joining her in the elevator, so once he knew which floor she'd stopped at, he went to the computer she'd been working on and tried to call up the last file that had been opened.
"She'd erased everything, of course," said Dexter.
"Of course," said Guttenberg.
"But what about the printout?"
"Again, no clue as to what was on it."
"She can't have lived with Connor Fitzgerald for 28 years and not picked up something about the way we work."
The officer left the library and waited in his car. After a few minutes, Mrs. Fitzgerald came out of the building. She was no longer carrying the tape, but she was...
"She must have deposited it in the audiovisual center."
"Exactly my thought," said Guttenberg.
"How many tapes does the university store in its library?"
"Over 25,000, said Guttenberg.
"We don't have enough time to go through them all," said Dexter.
"We wouldn't have if Mrs. Fitzgerald hadn't made her first mistake."
Dexter didn't interrupt this time.
"When she left the library, she didn't have the video, but she did have the printout. Our agent followed her to the admissions office, where I'm happy to say her principals got the better of her."
Dexter raised an eyebrow.
Before returning to her office, Mrs. Fitzgerald called in at the recycling center. She's not the vice president of GULP by accident.
GULP?
Georgetown University Litter Patrol. She dumped the printout in the paper depository.
Good. So what did you find on it?
A complete list of the videos currently on loan and unlikely to be returned until the beginning of next term.
So she must have felt it was safe to leave her video in an empty box because no one would come across it for weeks.
Correct, said Guttenberg. How many videos are there that fall into that category?
472, replied Guttenberg.
Presumably you've requisitioned every one.
I thought about doing that, but if an inquisitive student or member of staff became aware of a CIA presence on the campus, all hell would break loose.
Good thinking, said Dexter. So, how do you intend to go about finding that video?
I've detailed a dozen hand-picked officers, all recent graduates, to check out every one of the titles on that list until they come across a homemade video in what should be an empty box. The problem is that despite their being dressed like students, I can't afford to leave any one of them inside the library for longer than 20 minutes, or let them go there more than twice in a day if they're not going to stick out like sore thumbs. So the exercise is proving rather time-consuming.
How long do you think it will be before they find it?
We could get lucky and come across it almost immediately, but my bet is that it will probably take a day or two, three at the most.
Don't forget you have to be back in touch with Mrs. Fitzgerald in less than 48 hours.
I hadn't forgotten. But if we find the tape before then, that won't be necessary.
Unless Mrs. Fitzgerald also recorded her phone conversation with you.
Guttenberg smiled. She did. But it was erased within seconds of her replacing the receiver. You should have seen the pleasure it gave Professor Ziegler to demonstrate his latest toy.
Excellent,
said Dexter. Ring me the moment you get your hands on that video. Then there will be nothing to stop us eliminating the one person who could still... The red phone on her desk began to ring, and she grabbed it without completing her sentence. The director, she said, pressing a button on her stopwatch. When did this happen? Are you absolutely certain? And Jackson, where is he? When she had heard the reply, she immediately put the phone down. Guttenberg noticed that the stopwatch had reached 43 seconds. I do hope you find that videotape within the next 48 hours, said the director, looking across the desk at her deputy. Why? Asked Guttenberg, looking anxious. Because Mitchell tells me that Fitzgerald was hanged at 8 o'clock this morning, St. Petersburg time, and that Jackson has just boarded a United Airways flight out of Frankfurt, bound for Washington. Book 3. The Hired Assassin. Chapter 24. At 7 a.m., the three thugs entered his cell and marched him off to the chief's office. Once they had left the room, Bolchenkov locked the door and without a word went over to a wardrobe in the corner. Inside was a policeman's uniform, which he indicated Connor should change into. Because of his loss of weight over the past week, the clothes hung on him, and he was grateful for the braces. But with the aid of a wide-brimmed hat and a long blue coat, he managed to look like any of the 1,000 policemen who would be walking the beat in St. Petersburg that morning. He left his prison clothes at the bottom of the wardrobe, wondering how the chief would dispose of them. Still, without saying a word, Bolchenkov ushered him out of his office and into a tiny anteroom, then locked him in. After a long silence, Connor heard a door opening, then footsteps, followed by another door opening, which could have been the wardrobe in the chief's office. He didn't move a muscle as he tried to work out what was going on. The first door opened again, and 2, possibly 3 people rushed noisily into the office. They left a few seconds later, dragging something or someone out of the room and slamming the door behind them. Moments later, the door was unlocked, and Bolchenkov indicated that he should come out. They went through the office and back into the corridor. If the chief turned left, they would be returning to his cell. But he turned right. Connor's legs felt very weak, but he followed as quickly as he could. The first thing he saw when he stepped into the courtyard was the scaffold, and someone placing a magnificent gilded chair with plush red upholstery a few paces in front of it. He didn't need to be told who would be sitting there. As he and Bolchenkov walked across the yard, Connor noticed a group of policemen dressed in long blue coats like the one he was wearing, dragging passers-by off the street, presumably to witness the execution. The chief moved quickly across the gravel to a car on the far side of the courtyard. Connor was about to open the passenger door when Bolchenkov shook his head and pointed to the driver's seat. Connor took his place behind the wheel. "Drive up to the gate, and then stop," said the chief as he got into the passenger seat. Connor kept the car in first gear as he drove slowly across the yard, stopping in front of 2 guards posted by the closed gate. One of them saluted the chief and immediately began checking under the vehicle while the other looked through the back window and inspected the boot. The chief leaned across and pulled down the sleeve on Connor's left wrist. When the guards had completed their search, they returned to their positions and saluted Bolchenkov once again. Neither of them took the slightest interest in the driver. The vast wooden bolts were removed, and the great gates of the crucifix prison were pulled open. "Get moving," said the chief under his breath as a small boy ran into the prison compound, looking as if he knew exactly where he was going. "Which way?" Connor whispered. "Right." Connor swung the car across the road and began driving alongside the Neva towards the city center. There wasn't another car in sight. "Cross the next bridge," said Bolchenkov, "then take the first left." As they passed the prison on the far side of the river, Connor glanced across at its high walls. The police were still trying to coax people in to add to the small crowd who had already gathered to witness his hanging. How was Bolchenkov going to get away with it? Connor continued driving for another couple of 100 meters until Bolchenkov said, "Pull over here." He slowed down, and brought the car to a halt behind a large white BMW with one of its rear doors open. "This is where we part company, Mr. Fitzgerald," said Bolchenkov. "Let's hope we never meet again." Connor nodded his agreement. As he stepped out of the car, the chief added, "You are privileged to have such a remarkable friend." It was to be some time before Connor understood the full significance of his words. "Your flight leaves from Gate 11, Mr. Jackson. It will be boarding in 20 minutes. "Thank you," said Connor as he picked up his boarding pass. He began walking slowly towards departures, hoping the official wouldn't check his passport too closely. Although they had replaced Jackson's photograph with his, Chris was 3 years older than him, 2 inches shorter, and was bald. If he was asked to remove his hat, he would have to explain why his head was covered in Gorbachev-like marks. In California, they would simply have assumed he was a cult member. He handed his passport over with his right hand. If he had used his left, the sleeve would have risen to reveal the tattooed number on his wrist. Once he was back in America, he would buy himself a wider watch strap. The official gave the passport only a cursory glance before allowing him through. His newly acquired suitcase, containing nothing more than a change of clothes and a sponge bag, passed through security without hindrance. He picked it up and made his way to Gate 11, where he took a seat in the far corner of the lounge, facing away from the exit that led to the plane. In the 24 hours since he had left the crucifix, Connor hadn't relaxed for one moment. "This is the first call for Finnair Flight 821 to Frankfurt," said a voice over the intercom. Connor didn't move. If they had told him the truth, he would never have allowed Chris to take his place. He tried to piece together everything that had happened after he had left Bolchenkov. He had got out of the police car and walked as quickly as he could to the waiting BMW. The chief had already begun his return journey to the crucifix by the time Connor climbed into the back of the car and sat beside a pale, thin young man wearing a long black cashmere coat. Neither he nor the two similarly dressed men seated in the front of the car spoke or even acknowledged his presence. The BMW eased out onto the empty road and moved quickly away from the city. Once they joined the highway, the driver ignored the speed limit. As 8 o'clock flicked up on the dashboard clock, a road sign told Connor that they were 150 kilometers from the Finnish border. As the distance on the signs dropped to 100 kilometers, then 50, then 30, then 10, Connor began to wonder how they were going to explain the presence of a Russian policeman to the border guards. But no explanation proved necessary. When the BMW was about 300 meters from the no-man's land that divided the two countries, the driver flashed his lights 4 times. The barrier at the frontier rose immediately, allowing them to cross the border into Finland without even dropping their speed. Connor was beginning to appreciate the extent of the Russian mafia's influence. No one in the car had uttered a word since their journey had begun, and once again the road signs gave Connor the only clue as to where they were heading. He began to think Helsinki must be their destination, but 12 kilometers before they reached the outskirts of the city, they took a slip road off the highway. The car slowed as the driver maneuvered over potholes and around blind bends that led deeper and deeper into the countryside. Connor gazed at the barren landscape, covered in a thick layer of snow. "This is the second call for Finnair Flight 821 to Frankfurt. Would all passengers please board the aircraft?" Connor still didn't move. 40 minutes after leaving the highway, the car turned into the yard of what appeared to be a deserted farmhouse. A door was opened even before they had come to a halt. The tall young man jumped out and led Connor into the house. He didn't acknowledge the cowering woman they passed as they marched in. Connor followed him up a flight of stairs to the first landing. The Russian opened a door, and Connor entered the room. The door was slammed behind them, and he heard another key turning in another lock. He walked across the room and looked out of the only window. One of the bodyguards was standing in the yard, staring up at him. He moved away from the window and noticed that a complete set of clothes and a black rabbit-skin hat had been laid out on a small, uncomfortable-looking bed. Connor stripped off all his clothes and threw them over a chair by the bed. In a corner of the room was a plastic curtain, and behind it, a rusty shower. With the aid of a rough bar of soap and a trickle of lukewarm water, Connor spent several minutes trying to remove the stench of the crucifix from his body. He dried himself with two dishcloths. When he looked in the mirror, he realized that it would be some time before the scars on his head would heal and his hair return to its natural length. But the number tattooed on his wrist would be with him for the rest of his life. He dressed in the clothes that had been left on the bed. Although the trousers were a couple of inches too short, the shirt and jacket fitted quite well, even though he must have lost at least 10 pounds while he was in prison. There was a gentle knock on the door, and the key turned in the lock. The woman, who had been in the hall when they had arrived, was standing there holding a tray. She placed it on the side table and slipped back out before Connor could thank her. He looked down at the bowl of warm broth and three bread rolls and literally licked his lips. He sat down and began to attack the food, but after sipping a few spoonfuls of soup and devouring one of the rolls, he felt full. Suddenly, overcome by drowsiness, he slumped down on the bed. This is the third call.